You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the Art World Demystified.
Today on our show, we're talking with Adam Moskowitz. Adam, thanks so much for being with us today.
Glad to be here.
So let's jump into what you're involved in right now with the gallery. I think just to help our listeners, can you define your role and what you're doing at this moment?
Sure. So the gallery is Moskowitz Gallery, and it's been open for 2 years in Los Angeles in the heart of Hollywood. And I have basically, we're on our ninth exhibition, and I have single-handedly mounted all nine exhibitions. And my job is really very much working closely with all the artists that I represent. It's only six of us. But it was a very organic way in which it started and formed. And now, on top of all the work that goes into just keeping in touch, but coming up with ideas for exhibitions and then seeing them all the way through is really what I do. But I wear many hats, so mounting exhibitions is one thing. But the programming at the gallery, the public programming, is equally as important to me as mounting an exhibition would be.
And let's go back to the beginning of it, your first involvement in it then. How did that begin, founding
it? So I guess it began on the East Coast where I was going to school. I went to Berklee College of Music and the School of the Museum of Fine Arts. I was doing a cross studies program there. So I'm a musician, and that is my background. I'm a classical violinist. So when I was studying music production engineering and violin, I started to do cross studies at the School of the Museum of Fine Arts for photography and printmaking. And while I was there, my main goal became understanding the intersections of the arts, so really the core that makes art work. It is the same in poetry, it's the same in music, it's the same in visual arts. Any artist that you talk to will say that they have incredible kinships with interdisciplinary artists. So that became my ultimate fascination, seeing as I came from music, which is a very just pure art form to me. And I came to know a number of visual artists at the School of the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston who were doing really exemplary things. And we kind of grew together. And Boston's contemporary art scene is very, very small. I think it can fit on like a pinhead. And so after we all graduated, I just kind of backdoored into being the one who mounted exhibitions of people's works because I was deeply interested in art history, very, very fascinated with how I could correlate things to history to give them relevance. And it just we all outgrew Boston, and I needed to pick basically between two epicenters of art, LA and New York. And for me, there was really no question that LA was going to be the place where I would have the most freedom to do what I was going to do.
So let's talk about the first show. How did that begin? You say kind of backdoor, that it sounds very easy, but how did the first show happen? How was that organized?
Yeah, it does sound easy when I say that, but it's definitely not. It probably was the better part of a year in which the very first show that I ever organized came about, and it came from a lot of conversation with artists and understanding that there were four artists mainly that I was talking to. That's Alexa Guardiola, Bill Moss, Mitch Weiss, and myself, actually. And understanding that all of these, their works had an incredible dialogue, even though they were not necessarily talking to each other. I was the one talking to them, and then talking to the next person, talking to the next person, and through a series of conversations over the course of a year, it just came to the fore that this was really something that could be connected, and not necessarily interdisciplinary for everybody, but in specifics, if I'm going to break it down really fast, it's looking at contemporary art as not purely conceptual anymore, but moving away from concept to incorporate concept and aesthetics, or concept and form, a marriage of the two, instead of pure conceptualism.
That's what you're saying, that's the kind of program of the gallery, so to speak?
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, that, and that's really loaded to just say right off the bat, and I know that it's narrowly impossible to try and describe what art would look like or feel like. But I do think that if you look at kind of big overarching, you know, pendulum shifts in how artwork kind of gets to the very, very end of something, you know, and then gets reined back in a different direction. And I always think of this pendulum, you know, you can think of romanticism and classicism competing with each other. And you can see those shifts taking place because everybody reacts against something else. And to try and predict those things or try and see where things went, you know, at the end of the 80s, we had these very highly conceptual shows, very, very in-depth curation going on, and artists really not even making objects anymore. Where does it go from there? And that's an interesting question to ask. I think we're all asking that question now. So,
well, it's a reaction, isn't it? The reaction is, it sounds like, and sorry for interrupting, but it sounds like the argument is objects, is an aesthetic that's object-oriented.
Yeah, it is, and that's very true. I think that's a better way to put it, too. I mean, all the artists that I'm interested in and invested in are making objects. That's not to say that I haven't seen great artwork that doesn't have an object. It's just when I think of now and the contemporary, and everyone talks about the internet being like a big part of art making, which it totally is. However, there's still another side to it. There's still another side to humanity besides the online world, and so. To me, art has a power, a great power to do this, to pull you out of that idea of the online world and to put you in human connectivity, to put you in a space physically with somebody. I mean, it's another reason why I have a physical gallery, because I still believe in exhibitions, to go and to look for long periods of time. You know,
as a social activity, I mean, you're talking about it as a very physical social activity. It's not an online experience, which, of course, it's true. Art really isn't an online experience, right?
Exactly. And any painter that you talk to is going to wax poetically about the tactility of the medium that they're using, whether it's paint or ink or gouache or oil or, you know, it doesn't matter. It's always about being able to stand in front of it and kind of mind the object. And you can't do that the same way online. So there are two sides to the coin, and I think that anybody that tries to make the argument for art going completely online and art galleries going defunct because brick-and-mortar spaces are no longer relevant, it's just that's an extreme that I don't think will ever happen. I'm fighting for it not to happen, at least.
And then what else, are you fighting for as the gallery evolves? So it's growing. I imagine it's sustaining itself now. Producing some kind of income, and where do you see the gallery in terms of the international market and art fairs?
Yeah, well, I mean, it's been, you know, 2 years of rough and tumble, but pulling by, and there's some really exciting things happening in terms of growing and expanding. I did just partner. I have a new business partner. Meredith Bays, and the gallery will be changing names from Moskowitz Gallery to Moskowitz Bays in the fall to reflect the new partnership. But part of the things that comes with that is the growing of the gallery program. We're trying to focus a lot more on Los Angeles artists because we are here, and there's so much happening. So we've been doing studio visits for the last 8 months, and they've been incredibly exciting, seeing some unbelievable artists work on some amazing things in their studios. Everything from, you know, wild sculpture to mixed media. We're not really focused on a specific medium. We're more focused on that idea of rigorous practice, producing objects that are both conceptually and, you know, formally relevant. So that expansion will happen, and I will look to art fairs in this next coming year. I just couldn't do it in the first 2 years. I don't think any gallery that's first starting off kind of like I did from the ground is going to be able to even conceive of doing an art fair. And if they can, then that's amazing. And kudos. I just do it.
Well, so that's an exciting, I'm just seeing where you're going with that. So that is the potential future of it. And obviously growth with this new partner. And when, and just to talk a little bit more about the studio visits, when you're doing these studio visits, you mentioned, you know, the term relevancy, you know, what criteria do you think you use, or do both of you use when doing these studio visits, that makes a work relevant to you or meaningful to you, if that's possible to say?
That's a fascinating question. Yeah, I think there are a number of things, and ultimately it always starts off with, I mean, it's such a range of a gamut of what an artist will prepare for you. Some artists won't do anything, and, you know, you'll go in into, like, the crazy confusion of what their brain exploded looks like. And other artists will really prepare a small kind of exhibition for you to look at. Regardless, the first thing that I'm doing is looking and trying to engage and understand for myself what's going on before I come to any conclusions or start asking questions. I treat it similarly to how I would view an exhibition in a museum, even if there is no exhibition to see and there's just objects. You know, I'm always interested in where my brain will go before I read the text, before I'm trying to understand things conceptually from the artist's perspective. What is it from my perspective, and subsequently from some just innocent bystander's perspective? And then after I do that, I inevitably come up with some questions, even if it's just process-oriented. But coming through those questions and seeing how an artist will gauge them or react to them is a big criteria for understanding if they, A, fit into our program. I mean, there's a lot of times where I'll do a studio visit and think the artist is brilliant, just not quite understand how I would be able to work with that particular artist in context of what we're doing. Maybe I can recommend them to somebody else, but when I'm really fixated and interested in their work and think it can be relevant, it's hard to define exactly what pinpoints it, without getting into, you know, taste-oriented things that I think are very specific to me.
Well, I think it's interesting, right? No, you're right. Of course, it's really very broad. But you talking about the difference between a studio visit that looks like was that really like someone's brain exploded, or something more prepared, more narrative, is very interesting. Obviously, it sounds like the studio visit that's more narrative or prepared is the one that's more attractive.
Yeah, it is. But like, I'll give you an example of one that might have not necessarily been. It was like half and half. You know, this particular artist had, you know, vats of highlighter fluid laying around everywhere when we walked in, and that was really interesting. Except I also saw anatomical drawings of horses on the walls that reminded me of a lot of George stuff, and sure, if I ask, and they were anatomical pencil drawings that he was doing based off of George Stubbs. So how does vats of highlighter fluid correlate to George Stubbs? And he led me down this path that ultimately explained it, but it wasn't necessarily set up to do that. One was a different experiment, and they didn't really have correlation. So it was a very, you know, things like that either happen organically or not when artists hide things and you don't get to see the vat of the highlighter fluid. Does that make sense?
I think so. You're saying you'd rather it be revealed right away.
Yeah. I mean, you do a studio visit so you can understand the artist's practice. And often, here's an even better example. Alexa Gorelia is an incredible painter that we represent. And her studio is in Boston, and she kind of needs to be isolated for a number of reasons, and so she chooses Boston, but then she goes back and forth from New York. She comes out to Los Angeles a lot. Her studio is, I mean, it looks like a 19th century like scientist laboratory, but she's a painter, and what we exhibit are gorgeous paintings that are really reminiscent of a lot of things, but it's gouache and ink on paper. And they range from pure abstractions to configuration that is really indicative of only her. This is her style. She really has a specific style. So I go into her studio, and you can barely walk in it. How does a painter have a studio that you can barely walk in with sculpture everywhere? So she's collecting objects, building things, not to exhibit, but to look at for herself to be able to paint. And that's a really interesting practice that goes into a different field. Maybe she's not a sculptor, but she needs it to make her work. And that's not something that you would get from an exhibition of her work. You would only see paintings if you walk into an exhibition of her work. Another artist, a great example, is Claire Anna Baker, who's an artist that's going to be added to our roster in the fall. She's a Los Angeles-based artist, and she actually builds what she calls a source installation that looks like a 7.5-foot pile of rubble, you know, like mannequin arms and mirrors and dirt and streamers and foil, just weird, really crazy. And she draws from this object, literally with a you know, draws the abstract space that the object creates, and will then translate that to much larger scale paintings with a huge, massive steel blade on polyester with ink. And you'd think there's no way that these things have correlation, except when you talk to her about it and you're in her studio, it makes perfect sense. It's like an incredible logical train how she collected things from this specific place and built this object and is very interested in the poetics of space, and so she needed to create an abstract space to draw in and engage with. So she did it. Does that make sense?
That does, and that sounds like a very interesting studio visit. And those were ideas, essentially, she introduced you to in the kind of narrative of her studio visit.
Absolutely. I mean, I was in that particular studio visit. I'm looking at, she's got books open by Nicolas Poussin, and I'm thinking, here's a completely classical painter, and she's deeply obsessed with the poetic idea in this one painting. And she's telling me that it's coming up again and again in her work, in this body of work that she's working on. And whether or not, you know, that can't be conveyed because it's purely abstract painting. So the quote, innocent bystander looking at that isn't going to deduce Nicolas Poussin, but maybe the feeling that they get from looking at it, the kind of mystery and intrigue, might be exactly akin to the dark pond that was in Nicolas Poussin's painting that she was pulling this from.
Interesting. And when you share that interest in history, which is also a nice point to kind of understand someone. So tell me about what's happening. It's great talking to you about this and how you're thinking about the gallery and the growth of it. What shows are coming up? This interview is running for the summer of 2015, so.
Okay, great. So basically the end of our summer program ends August 1st, and it's the last show of Moskowitz Gallery. Like I said, we're changing over to Moskowitz Bays in the fall. And the second weekend of September, we will open as Moskowitz Bays, a little bit of renovations to our space. And, of course, the signage will change over, and we will add those additional artists. But we're opening in the fall with an artist, Anthony Mezzarandino, who is really a tremendous sculptor. He's a MFA graduate from UCLA and a very, very studious worker, kind of, and doing relief work right now in a very untraditional method of relief. So a lot of his relief casts are made from acrylic paint, but all monochrome, so like a silvery metallic acrylic, and it reads like graphite. And this is a huge acrylic skin that's been, you know, draped and laid over a small board that's on a wall, so it just kind of hangs there. And it's feels very new, except it also feels like this man has studied sculpture and relief in an incredible way, in an incredibly in-depth way to get to this kind of new form of making. So that'll be in the fall, and I'm excited for that specifically because we haven't really had a sculpture show in the gallery or something to include three-dimensional work yet. So that's going to be great.
Well, but that also sounds like it articulates the program, as you were saying earlier, that artist sounds like a type of post-conceptualism or whatever you would call what we were discussing and your program was articulating.
Yes, I mean, very much so. I think the one thing that people might come away from is understanding that, you know, the artists aren't linked by the fact that they're, like I said, that they're medium or even the way that they think is not linked, but the way that they practice what they do. I keep coming back to that word because for me, as a violinist, the idea of practice was, you know, you sit in a room for 5 hours and you play scales with a metronome. And somehow in visual art, this idea of practice is a little bit skewed. It's kind of different. But the artists that I talk to and that I represent and know, they do have that idea of practice. When they're in their studio, they're working, even if it's just sitting and staring at a wall and thinking about how they're going to execute something. They put in so much time into thinking about new processes that eventually they come up with them. And that's the exciting part for contemporary art for me, is the newness of it. So
that is exciting. It's also very exciting to me in talking to you. I mean, it's interesting how your interest as a musician, as a classical musician, I mean, pursuing that, I don't know if you still play or not, but how that kind
of
informs how you're thinking. So you still play and you still practice?
100%. I play every day, and it definitely informs greatly, you know, what I do. I always say that kind of my brain formed as a musician, and the way that the structures in which I think and problem solve are logic-based, kind of founded in classical music. You know, the very forms that classical music presents are incredibly thought out and beautiful when they're completely understood. And studying that has totally affected how I view art in general. It was why I came to visual artwork. I mean, I can remember like looking at Kandinsky, for example, in an art museum, not knowing who Kandinsky was, having this unbelievable distinct feeling that there was rhythm that was translating to line and harmony translating to color, and felt incredibly musical. And then, of course, I look at the title, and the title is, you know, Symphony in whatever color. It was just, it's just right there. Or Improvisation number 4. I had the same experience with Whistler. It's how I look at artwork. I'm looking for, and this is why I'm interested in objects, because I think that the way your eye can move around the page can directly affect you. The way that color can permeate your subconscious is real. So music definitely led me to like harbor these deep-seated, rooted, grounded understandings of artwork that some people might call into contention that studied visual art first. It's kind of interesting for me, too.
Yeah, I think it's very interesting for me, too. I mean, I also come from both backgrounds, so I can appreciate that, and I think it certainly does contribute. And I think really the way you're talking about it reminds me of a phrase, I think, my father told me, who was quoting from somewhere, saying, you know, music is the prince of all the arts because because it's so abstract, because it's so something so rich about it.
Well, it's great you bring that up, too. I mean, Kandinsky said music is the highest art form, which is interesting word choices, too, because it's not the best. I'm not trying to make qualifiers on it, but I do think that it can be considered the highest in that it conveys really, really true human emotion. I mean, you can talk to anybody. Most people that I've talked to like music. I've met very little people who haven't. And everybody loves it for the reason that it's given them, you know, hairs on the back of their neck or tears come to their eyes or a certain song is associated with something else. But especially songs without lyrics, they have really nothing tangible for us to latch onto except for harmony and rhythm in order and structure. And that can convey deep, deep emotion. I think probably those experiences that experiences that I had in concert halls, you know, when I was in school, I was fortunate to be able to see world-class orchestras. I was seeing concerts like 3 or 4 times a week, and sometimes I would go to New England Conservatory and be one of 5 people in an audience for one of the best string quartets in the world. And I have these wild moments where I was having, like, fits of tears coming to my eyes. Feels like kind of weird saying that, but, you know, you just can't control crying, and you're not crying from sadness or happiness. You just have no idea what is going on. And all this emotions are flooding you. You can't even pinpoint what the emotions are. For that reason, I think that music is, or at least for me, has been by far the most powerful thing. But I do think that art can bring you there, too. Visual art can bring you there, too. So how it's done is another story.
Well, I agree. And Adam, it's been a pleasure talking with you today. Thanks so much for your conversation.
Thank you very much. I appreciate it.
You're listening to Yale Radio WIBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the Art World Demystified.